This is the Alternative Media, exposing government corruption, defending our suspended Constitution, demanding the rights of we the people, broadcasting the truth. The puppet media dare not report. Long live liberty and death to the New World Order. Prepare yourself. This is the Alternative Media.
Representation of we the people. It is Saturday, December 17th, 2016. We're in hour one of the broadcast. The website, thealternativemedia.com. You can email me, thealternativemedia@yahoo.com. John Kaminsky is going to be joining me all the first hour. Second hour, I'm going to be running down through the news. And then in the third hour, we've got an interview that Dr. Patrick Slattery did this week with Don Adbo. And they're going to be discussing why white people shouldn't be ashamed of slavery, what happened in the past. They're going to be going down through a lot of pertinent facts. It's an interesting interview. I think you'll really enjoy it. And I'm looking forward to having John Kaminsky on. You know, we have, even beyond my wildest expectations a couple of weeks ago when I was saying that the new buzzword, I think it was in late November, it was before Thanksgiving, the new buzzword was going to be fake news. Even beyond my wildest dream has the mainstream media and the body politic jumped on this this hoax that they are perpetrating. Actually, the hoaxers of the fake news, because they're being beaten to death by alternative media doing the job they won't do, has come out with this new narrative. And they're using Facebook, Google, and all the various platforms to try to eliminate those exposing the lies and disinformation that they continue to disseminate. You know, Drudge Report's had the story. There's been several media outlets had the story about how the electors are being pushed to not vote for Donald Trump, and the mainstream media is covering a lot of the celebrities. I didn't actually know until just shortly before coming on the broadcast that they're running those commercials on TV. These various celebrities claiming that they don't want the electors to vote for Donald Trump. And this is all the while I was watching Lester Cuckolt on NBC News. And I'm here to tell you, and we'll get into that a little more next hour, but they have got to be the absolute worst news outlet there is. I know it's hard to put that on one, but the disinformation that they disseminate constantly, especially with regards to Syria. I mean, they keep everyone so confused, but what's actually happening in Syria, and Aleppo's being liberated. And on the news last night, they were showing all these orphans, you know, and oh, the orphans, and it was so bad, and they were just, but never do they discuss the fact that, well, maybe all their fathers run off to Germany, you know, to rape white women. They never discuss that fact, that the epitome of a coward would be to leave your women and children and elderly behind so you could run off to European nations. But all this is being done by design. All of this is being done by design to destroy Europe. And the thing I think that they're most terrified of is not Donald Trump. It's the fact that there could be a mass awakening of the people that are seeing through this litany of lies. We're waiting to, I hope we didn't have any miscommunication. I hope that we are able to get John Kaminsky on.
Well, hello, gang, and welcome to another episode of National Bugle Radio. And today I have with me Mark Collette, the activist and author from Great Britain. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to come on the show with you.
Well, it's great to have you on, and we're here today to talk about your new book, The Fall of Western Man. Now, the rise of Western civilization, perhaps arguably, I wouldn't argue it though, is the most significant event in the history of mankind. And it was the people of Europe, and earlier, I suppose, some of the people of the Middle East who were in part the instigators of it, but really, it was the European people who are responsible for the rise of Western civilization, which has created an entire world of technology and civilization and long lifespans and modern living, enormously higher lifestyles than anybody could have imagined. And yet, these very people who created Western civilization are now on the brink of disappearing from the earth, at least in the form that we would recognize them in. The birth rates are low. High immigration into the Western societies is leading to a situation where, within our own lifetimes, we're going to see the Westerners in the Western countries become a minority in the very countries that they've been occupying for countless generations. And yet, nobody's really talking about this. So we have the fall of Western man. And now you've written a book on it, and you're looking at it from really a psychological perspective, aren't you?
Well, yes, I am. I mean, I've listed the book on one of the sites it's available under self-improvement. And essentially, if you can allow me to draw a short analogy, if your car wasn't working anymore and you wanted to fix it, you'd have to understand how the car worked, how the engine worked in order to fix the car. And it's very similar with us. Everything seems to be going wrong, and we don't seem to be functioning anymore in the correct manner. And that's causing our community to fall apart. That's causing our society to go into a moral and social decline, and it's destroying our civilization. But for us to understand where we're going wrong, we have to understand the working of our own minds, and we have to understand how it has been possible for those who seek to destroy us to take us off track and lead us down such a destructive path.
Right. So it might seem, well, out of all of the approaches you could take to looking at the fall of Western man, why psychology? But of course, why not psychology? Because it's not as if we're facing armed invaders. We're letting people invade us. We are letting people take over our societies. It's self-inflicted, and that is kind of a psychological pathology, isn't it?
Well, in the book, I contend that essentially there is such a thing as a perfect society. And a perfect society is made up of an extremely homogeneous group, people who look alike, who have shared values, who have shared traditions, who have a shared heritage, and all are bound together by a shared culture. Now, we, as Western people, are now in an imperfect society, a society which is no longer homogeneous, a society which is actually now a wider society, one that is composed of many different individual cultural groups. And unfortunately, when you're placed in that situation where there are many different cultural groups which are all distinct and individual, living inside one wider society, eventually that creates conflict, it creates friction between the groups. Each group lobbies and campaigns for a better deal for their own people. And often, the cultures, values, and morals in those different groups are not only different, but sometimes actively moving in the opposite direction, which causes the wider society to tear itself to pieces and to fracture. And that can lead to civil conflict, and ultimately, it will eventually lead to one or more groups being dominated by other, more dominant, more cohesive and stronger cultural groups within the wider society. And unfortunately for Western man, our cultural group is becoming disparate. It's breaking apart. We're losing our culture. We're losing our heritage. We are losing our way of life and what made us great. Whilst those who are coming to our countries, those who are the invaders, are retaining their culture, they're retaining their way of life, and they're holding on to their traditions. So whilst they remain strong, cohesive and homogeneous and work together for the betterment of their own cultural group, we as a people have become disparate and we don't even view our culture and heritage. Well, we do, but people within our cultural group, Europeans, don't view our cultural heritage as important anymore. And because of that, we are becoming the weaker group within European nations. And because of that, we are now on the brink of complete moral and social collapse. And of course, our birth rate's in such sharp decline that we are looking like we are going to be bred out. This is white genocide. And part of this is obviously because huge number of immigrants have come to our country. But I contend that even though mass immigration has taken place, if Western man was still a homogenous and culturally cohesive group that put heritage and tradition first, we could hold the line, we could stem the tide, and we could weather this storm. Mm-hmm. But without those things, without a culturally cohesive group, without holding on to our traditions, we just become individuals. And once we are individuals, we are lost and we are easy prey for our envious migrant aggressors.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned the word cohesion numerous times. It seems that the reason that Western man is in decline and is losing his societies and his countries to outsiders, it's not because these outsiders have greater talent, that they have greater inherent strengths or abilities, but that they have cohesion, that they act as a group, and that Westerners no longer act as a group. Is that what you're saying?
Essentially, it is, yes. And often when you see some of these people coming into our European nations or into America, these people, they don't have the talents that we have. They don't have the rich culture, the rich heritage. They come from places that haven't had the cultural achievements, haven't had the artistic achievements, the literary achievements. They haven't put a man on the moon. They haven't invented air travel. Yet they're getting the upper hand. And that's not because they are better than us. It is because we have been reduced in our capacity to work as a cohesive group, which leaves us as individuals. And there's a chapter in my book called The Cult of Individualism, which actually details how we as a people now chase this drive for individuality, to be the ultimate individual, the person that everyone's looking at. We go through so many different phases and fads in order to achieve this, whether it's body modification, whether it's the color of our hair, whether it's the clothes that we wear, whether it's the crazy things that we do, our pastimes, our hobbies, the musical subcultures we adhere to. But we're all trying to stand out from the crowd, which makes us a group of individuals. We're not cohesive. Just take Muslims in a place like London, for example. When you see these people coming out of a mosque on a Friday afternoon, they are culturally cohesive. They, in some cases, look like an invading army. They are dressed the same. They are coming out of the same place of worship. They are coming out as families in an ordered and disciplined fashion. And they look like one. They look like one group. You can tell who they are, what they adhere to, what their culture is, what their tradition is. You look at a group of Europeans. Could you say the same about them? And you can't, because they're all struggling to be individuals. But that means we no longer relate to one another like we used to. We no longer have the shared morals, the shared values, the shared interests. We no longer hold on to the traditions, the culture, and the heritage that bound us together and made us cohesive, because we're all struggling to be individuals.
Mm-hmm. So this cult of individualism, there are scholars like Kevin MacDonald, who's a psychologist, who talk about a historical strain of individualism as well as altruism within the West. But that's one strain. There has been communitarian strains. If you look at the United States during the Great Depression, people really came together during the Great Depression. There was a great deal of help. I know my mother talked about a mark that had been drawn on the sidewalk in front of her house. It was known that her aunt, who ran the household, would let unemployed people do some chores and get a meal. You know, there were a lot of, I guess they were calling hobos at the time. There was a lot of this. Hitchhiking in the 30s and 40s, hitchhiking was very, very common and very, very safe. And my father had hitchhiked across the country. Lots of people. Ralph Nader had hitchhiked back and forth and back and forth so many times. That's actually how he got into auto safety, is he saw so many accidents and he couldn't understand why cars weren't equipped with basic safety features like safety belts. That's a reflection of people helping each other, not an individualism, but a communitarianism. So it seems as if Western societies have a combination of individualism and communitarianism. But this cult of individualism that you speak of seems to have the upper hand now. And so my question would be, is this something that arose organically? Or listeners to my show know, I spend a lot of time talking about one particular group, and I know you're in Britain, and I don't want to get you in trouble with your own government and its laws. I talk about, in particular, a Jewish-dominated elite. Is this something that an elite, regardless of whom it's dominated by, but an elite that does not have the best interests of a Western man at heart, are they using their power and their influence to lead Western man into an individualism and perhaps altruism that is specifically designed to undermine it?
They are. And the best way for me to explain this isn't actually me explaining this. In my book, I approach things from the angle of Freudian psychoanalysis. And the interesting thing about Freud is Freud came up with the theory. Now, theory is, of course, extremely important. But really, it's whether that theory can be put into action that shows whether the theory is sound. And whilst Freud is a household name, his nephew, Edward Bernays, is relatively unknown. Yet in a very real way, Edward Bernays has influenced far more people than Freud has. Because Edward Bernays was the one who put Freud's theories into devastating effect. Now, I'm not going to go on at length how he did this, because there's a very illuminating documentary that Dr. David Duke actually informed me of called The Century of Self. Actually, when I was discussing my book with Dr. David Duke, he said to me, I see where you're coming from. Have you seen The Century of Self? And he was talking to me about Edward Bernays. And Bernays essentially went to the establishment, advertising agencies, the media, and put Freud's theories into practice. And he explained to these people how if you approached things in a certain way from this analytical point of view, you could influence people to do almost anything and turn them from moral, community-minded people into selfish, hedonistic individuals that could be controlled by the media and through advertising channels. And one of the things he did was he popularized smoking amongst women. Now, at the time, smoking wasn't popular amongst women. In fact, women were often wholly opposed to it. It smelled bad. It made their men smell bad. It made the houses smell bad. They thought it was dirty, unclean, and in some cases, even antisocial. Yet Edward Bernays helped the tobacco companies and advertising companies to popularize smoking amongst women. And he did so by getting role models and women who other women looked up to and modeled themselves on. He basically paid these women to publicly smoke. And by doing so, he got a generation of women to take up something that they never would have done otherwise. And by using these methods, by essentially creating a moral vacuum and then filling that vacuum with something poisonous, our enemies have managed to take us off track. And an example of this is when young people grow up, they have role models. Primarily in the home, a strong father figure, a disciplinarian, is the role model. He imparts discipline, order, and moral teachings to his family. Outside of the home, there are people like scout leaders, football coaches, teachers, all of these people instill order, discipline, and teachings to children. And outside of that, there are national role models who are people we look up to because of their outstanding contribution to our nations and to our national pride and national history. Now, the powers that be, the media, the establishment, those who have pushed the cultural Marxist agenda, have essentially broken the family unit, removed the father figure from the family. They have undermined and destroyed healthy role models in our community, and they have completely trashed our national role models and scrubbed them from the history books. In effect, they've created a vacuum. And what have they filled that vacuum with? The likes of Lady Gaga, Rihanna, Miley Cyrus, Madonna, Pete Doherty, Amy Winehouse, every degenerate you can think of. So rather than young people following healthy role models that will lead them down a productive and healthy path, they follow these degenerate role models who lead them to their own self-destruction, to a pit of despair. And this is exactly what Edward Bernays started when he began to sell his uncle's theories to advertising agencies, those in the media, and to the liberal establishment.
Mm-hmm. So Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, the founder of psychoanalysis. So you apply psychoanalytic theory to the fall of Western man. And I know there's a lot of people out there who might hear the name Sigmund Freud and be immediately turned off. Psychology is not my field, but a lot of psychoanalysis has been rejected or refuted. But does that mean it's not useful? I'd like to bring up another theory that's been completely rejected, and that's Ptolemy's theory of an Earth-centric solar system. So he had a system whereby the sun and the planets were going around the Earth. And, of course, if you follow the planets through the sky over the course of a year, you see they don't go in straight lines. They go in this kind of crazy course. So in his theory, he had the planets, which were going in circles around the Earth, but then they were inside other circles, and you had circles inside of circles. And it was a very complicated theory, obviously wrong, but it produced very good calendars. And so the calendars produced by Ptolemy were better than the calendars produced by Copernicus, who actually had a more or less correct interpretation of the relationship between the Earth and the sun and the planets. And so somebody out there who is turned off by Freudian theory should not be turned off by your book. Whether or not you think his conceptualization of the mind is correct, it can be useful. And I think in your book it is useful. And so you talk about the id and the ego and the superego. And it's very effective. So how do you use the id and the ego and the superego to describe how societies are formed, how a society like Western civilization comes about, and then how it's going into decline now?
Well, to any detractor, I would simply ask them, read the book. It's free. You can get it as a free download, so I'm not asking for money from you. Download it, read it, then I'm happy to debate this with anyone. But also watch The Century of Self. And we know we've gone down this destructive path. Look at how these people have set us on this course. Now, the superego is essentially the learned part of the psyche. It's what's imparted
maybe just
to us.
For a little primer for people, what's the id, what's the ego, and then what's the superego? And then
I'll just run through that very quickly. The id is our unconscious or subconscious primitive drives. They're things that we seek pleasure from. They're things that we need to survive. Things like the will to eat, the will to sleep, the will to sexually reproduce, the will to quench our thirst. And essentially, Freud called the id the pleasure principle. Now, the id doesn't reason on a moral level. It doesn't reason on a level of safety either, of personal safety. All the id does is seek pleasure. When the id wants something, if you feel hungry, the id wants you to satisfy that hunger. So it will set you on a path of relentlessly finding food until you satisfy it. The ego is what Freud called the reality principle. And that reasons with the id, again, not on a moral level, but on the level of safety. So let's draw a quick analogy here. If you're hungry and you need to eat, the id will say, look for food, look for food, look for food. And if you see a tasty steak sat on a window ledge on a plate, the id will say, take the steak, take the steak, and you will move to take the steak and eat it and satisfy your hunger. Now, let's say that steak was guarded by a vicious dog. The id would be take the steak, take the steak. But then the ego steps in. The ego is the reality principle. It stops you endangering yourself. The ego ultimately wants the id to be satisfied, but it is willing to withhold satisfaction to ensure that the individual survives for longer. So the id says, take the steak, but the ego says, no, the dog's going to get you. We better leave the steak because there'll be more steaks later down the line and we don't want to get chewed up ourselves. Now, the superego is something completely different. It's completely unique from the id and the ego. And the important facet of the superego is it's learned, it's morality, that it is principles. It is things that are imparted to you by your parents, by your role models, by your community. And it is learned behavior that reasons on a moral level. And that superego and a shared superego or community consciousness that exists between a group is what allows us to work as a group. It's like a community consciousness. It's a shared set of values and morals that allow us to function as a community. And to go back to our analogy of being hungry, if you were hungry and you were literally starving and you saw a child with a loaf of bread, the id would say, take the bread, take the bread, take the bread. The ego would reason that it was safe to take the bread. But your superego would then override both of those and say, no, it's wrong to take the bread from the child. It's wrong to steal. It's wrong to physically dominate another in that manner. And your morals would stop you taking the bread, even though you were both hungry and it was safe to do so. Now, my book expands more on this, but essentially the importance of the superego is it is our learned morality and values. And across Western civilization, across our communities, at one time, we had these shared morals and values, which were passed down to us by role models in our community, our parents, our teachers, and our national role models. And over time, these shared morals, these shared values, they became traditions. They became a rich heritage. They became our culture. And they were the things that bound us together. And in my book, I term this the Western superego. I mean, as an aside to this, originally the book was called The Death of the Western Superego, because that is essentially what we have lost. We have lost our shared morals, our shared values, and the things that bound us together as a community. And that is why we are becoming disparate individuals. That's why we no longer function like we used to. And that is why, increasingly, we are now on the wrong end of the stick when it comes to migrant communities getting favorable treatment, because they gather together, they lobby as a group, they act as a single voice, and they get what they're asking for. White people, Europeans, we don't do that because we have lost our community consciousness. Now, obviously, this is a very quick off-the-cuff explanation, and the book explains it in much greater detail. But I do urge listeners, please download it for free and give it a read. And believe me, it makes sense. And now we have lost our shared societal consciousness. We are individuals and we have lost our way.
So your original title had been The Death of the Western Superego. So it seems that certainly it's in decline relative to the id, the pleasure principle, where people are taught to just go out and free love and hook up with as many people as possible without consequences. The worry about consequences would be an ego function. And when you see AIDS rates going up because people don't even think about what might happen to them with sexually transmitted diseases, that would be the id overriding not just the superego, but the ego as well. Is there a perversion of what remains of the superego when you see the massive empathy towards, for instance, a Syrian child who's washed up on a beach in Turkey, and then what remains of a superego of morality gets extended, and very illogically, to these outgroups, when actually, to think logically, the reason that boy was washed up on the beach was because his parents put him on a crazy boat in order to get into Europe, leaving Turkey where they were facing no immediate danger. Is there also kind of a perversion of what remains of the superego?
Well, there certainly is, but I just want to go back to something you said at the beginning of that question. You summed it up perfectly. The poison we are being fed is to appeal to our id. It is so we become like debased cattle, where all we do is seek endless, individualistic, hedonistic pleasure. It's where we put off our own safety, we put the ego to one side, and we put all morality to one side too. And this is the message being pushed by these poisonous role models. So our young people go out, and rather than putting off pleasure for long-term gain, they now seek short-term pleasure at any cost, even to their long-term detriment. And the other point that you made is also fantastic, that the little superego we have left is a warped superego, which prioritizes the well-being of immigrants, outsiders, and minorities more than it prioritizes the good of our own community. So it's like a double-edged sword in that case. But really, the way I put it in the book is our enemies want us to be debased cattle. They want us to be, well, just to degenerate into complete madness. And that is what they've achieved. And when you see young people today and the way they live their lives, the way they chase drugs, the way they chase a partying lifestyle, the way they are willing to just give up on anything, their education, their career, just to go out and party and have endless sexual encounters and live for hedonism, you can see that the Western world is going down. And it's not a case of fiddling while Rome burns. It's a case of us dancing round, partying, and living this incredibly debauched hedonistic lifestyle as the whole of Western civilization burns.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have several chapters devoted to feminism. Obviously, you see feminism as one of the main instruments that is causing the downfall of Western man. You tie it to intra-family relationships and also to the reduction of the birth rate. So where is this feminism coming from, and how is it used so malevolently?
Well, you see, the key to the superego is it's learned. It's the learned part of the psyche. It's imparted to us from primarily our parents. And discipline and order is part of the superego, and that is primarily imparted to us by strong male role models, particularly a father figure in the home. And our enemies wanted to destroy our superego, our morality and our values, so that we function solely off our id, so we function solely, as I said, like debased cattle. And one way they've done this with devastating effect is to take the male out of the family unit. So they've taken away the one who imparts order, who imparts discipline. They've taken away the disciplinarian from the family. And this has had an absolutely devastating effect on the next generation. You see, when you have a mother, and I know this from being a child myself, when we did something wrong as kids, we could always get round our mum. If you said, I'm sorry, and you cried and you pleaded, your mother would always feel sorry for you, because the mother imparts the conscience. She imparts emotion to children. She doesn't impart order and discipline. So you'd always get round your mum, but you'd never get round your dad. When you played up and he put his foot down, when he took his belt off or his slipper off, you knew he meant business, and he wouldn't back down. You couldn't wangle your way out of the punishment with your dad. If he put his foot down, you were in trouble. He meant it, and the punishment stuck. And that's why we grew up respecting authority and discipline. And that's why so many children today don't, because feminism tells women you don't need a man. In fact, you need to be like a man. You need to ditch femininity. You need to ditch your womanly virtues and compete with men. The man's your enemy. Don't settle down with him. You can do better. Get a divorce. Go out and party. Meet other men. It doesn't matter if you've got three kids by three different men. Mm-hmm. And because of that, the family unit's been undermined. And we now have a war of the sexes, rather than men and women coming together as they should. Because remember, they're different for a reason. They're complementary pairs. They're meant to work together. Now, rather than working together, they're at war with one another, and this has destroyed the family unit. And as the woman tries to compete unnaturally with her male counterpart, what does she do? She is no longer loving and kind. She doesn't want to be a housewife and a mother. She wants to be at work, which means less children. So not only has this destroyed the family unit, but it's decimated our birth rate.
Mm-hmm. So it's not far-fetched to associate feminism with the dramatic rise in divorce rates, right?
No, of course not. I mean, look at what these feminists preach. They preach rape culture. They tell women that men hold power over them through the threat of rape. I mean, what an awful lie. And women grow up, they go to colleges, they go to universities, and their role models, their teachers, the ones who should be imparting to them a good moral superego. Remember, the superego is now gone. Our enemies have created a vacuum, and what fills that vacuum is poisonous messages, things that are meant to undermine our society. So these teachers, these role models, instead of telling young women good and healthy things, building a moral and virtuous superego, they tell women to hate men. They tell women that men are all potential rapists. They spread lies like a quarter to a third of all women on campus will be raped. So all of a sudden, women hate men. Women want to be lesbians. They don't want to settle down and have a family. And why would you? Why would you want to settle with your natural enemy, which is what feminists tell women that men are? And because of this, we've been absolutely torn asunder. Our family units no longer exist. And the nuclear family is what underpins Western society. It's the bedrock of our culture, traditions, and ways of life. And when I say that, I'm not just talking about traditional marriage. I'm talking about when we existed on the edge of ice sheets. We developed the nuclear family because if we didn't, we would never have survived. We developed the two-parent family model because men and women had to stick together in those frozen wastelands through the harshest months of the year. Because if they didn't, a single parent couldn't have brought up a child alone. Let's just think now, if you took away our wonderful civilization and went back to the Ice Age, and you put a woman with no food, no resources, no clothes, no tools, no house, with her newborn baby in November in Northern Europe, could she survive? Of course not. You needed to have a husband. You needed to work as a pair to care for and shelter your offspring. So the evolutionary advantage, the pressure, was to come together and form a nuclear family. And that was the first part of the Western superego. The first moral teaching, which was an evolutionary advantage, was to come together as a couple to look after your children and for the man to shelter and protect and provide for his woman so that their next generation could prosper.
Mm-hmm. So just as Western societies as a whole are just allowing for their countries to be, you could say, invaded, without a shot, but invaded, and their populations to be overtaken by these high birth rate populations from Africa and the Middle East and in the United States, you also include Latin America. Just as Western society is letting this happen to them, has Western man just let feminism happen? Why isn't there more of a male backlash against feminism? Or is there one that I'm missing?
There is a male backlash, but you've got to remember, they've done this carefully over a long period of time. It's not like we went from happy nuclear families to dyed-haired feminists walking down the streets with their breasts out and offensive slogans smeared across their chest as they spit at men in the street. It wasn't from one to the other overnight. It was a gradual process. And I talk of it a little bit like the old analogy of cooking a frog. If you chuck the frog in a pan of boiling water, it'll jump out. But if you slowly turn up the heat, the frog will sit there smiling as he's gently boiled to death. Mm. And that's exactly what they've done with the West. They've introduced these things over time. And it's the same with mass immigration. The death of the West isn't by the bullet and the gun. It's not some giant, glorious conflict like the Battle of Vienna or the Battle of Stalingrad, which is a huge turning point in Western civilization. The death of the West is a creeping death. It's a cancer. It's a dark shroud falling over our civilization. And it happens house by house, street by street, town by town, and city by city. It's a gradual process, and most people don't even notice it happening until one day they walk into their city centre and they've not been there for maybe a few years, or they moved away and now they've come back to their town of birth and it looks completely different. And they're like, I don't even recognise this place anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But because it didn't happen overnight, they never really opposed it. Because it's always a slippery slope. Or as I talked about on a podcast the other week about the sexual revolution, it's like a snowball rolling down a hill. It slowly gathers pace and momentum and gravity until eventually it's smashing through every barrier, every bulwark of decency.
Mm-hmm.
But it happens slowly over time.
And you talk about withering masculinity and the feminized male. So why haven't men stood up? Is it because they're becoming feminized themselves?
Well, the problem is, when you take strong male role models out of the equation, when you take the father out of the family, when you take strong national role models and confine them to the dustbin of history, and instead you put in front of men feminized, metrosexual males, that has a profound effect. It stops men developing their strong superego. Now, the superego is actually made up of two separate parts, and one of those parts is called the ideal self. Now, the ideal self is what we model ourselves upon. We model ourselves upon role models, our parents, people in our communities that we look up to. Now, young men would always base their ideal self on their father. When they were coming of age, they were taken out by their father and they became men. They would also base their ideal self on strong role models in their community and strong national role models. But when they're brought up in a single parent home, when they only have female role models, they become more feminine. And the other thing you have to take into account, everything has been sanitized. Everything that young men do has been taken and wrapped in cotton wool. Now, part of this is because when you're in a single parent family, the mother does worry. I used to remember my mum worrying about the crazy things we did as kids. I mean, we would go out there, we'd build rope swings, we'd build bridges across rivers, we'd go biking down slopes at breakneck speeds, we'd climb sheer cliff faces to show off to our friends. But my dad would always encourage me. He'd always be, come on, son, that's the manly thing to do. While my mum would always have a heart in her mouth and be panicking that I fell. Mm-hmm. But if all young boys have got is their mother, who wraps them in cotton wool because her natural instinct, and that's normal, by the way, the woman always wants to protect and nurture. And that's what makes women so special. They provide that emotional bond that keeps the family together. But young men need to indulge in manly and masculine activities, which increasingly they don't. And an example of this is we have an old English hobby. It's called conkers. You know what horse chestnuts are, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, well, at school, we used to wait for the conkers to fall from the tree, and we would pierce them and put a string through them. And then one person would hang their conker down, and the other person would whack it with their conker on a string. And you take it in turns to hang your conker, and you take it in turns to whack the conker. And eventually, one conker would shatter, and the other one wouldn't. And the winning boy would be the one whose conker survived the battle. You can't do that in school anymore. They've actually outlawed the old British tradition of conkers, because it doesn't pass health and safety. You can only do it if you wear special gloves and safety goggles so a child doesn't get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
They've sanitized everything. And of course, this has had a profound effect. Young men, they're no longer out in nature. They're not building rope swings. They're not out biking and playing and getting cuts and grazes. And these things used to be a badge of honor. We'd come home from a day out building a tree house, and the boy with the biggest cut on his arm, that would be a badge of honour. He'd show it off to his friends. But children don't do that anymore. They're sat indoors playing computer games for hours on end. They're looking at podcasts. They're watching things on YouTube. They're reading comic books. And they're not developing their masculine traits. Mm-hmm. And crucially, they don't understand group dynamics anymore. Young males don't understand how to interact with other young males in a natural and healthy manner. And because of this, they're becoming feminized, they're becoming weak. And that's why you see this sexual role reversal, where you've got these masculine butch feminists pushing about their weedy male companions who are bending over backwards to adhere to this feminist ideology, which is basically designed to humiliate them and defeat them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, for instance, in the music industry, there's been a promotion of people, talented as they may be, but a promotion of people like Elton John or Michael Jackson or George Michael, who aren't necessarily the most masculine role models?
Well, the music industry's got a lot to answer for. I mean, I could talk to you till the cows come home about the music industry. And there's several examples in my book of how people like Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, and Rihanna have pushed this devastating assault on the young minds of people by pushing a terrible and destructive message. But talking about males in the music industry, of course, they're all feminized. Most of them are skinny and effeminate. A lot of them are homosexual. And they all constantly push an emotive and an emotional message. And you've got young men, instead of acting masculine, strong, like young warriors, they're sat listening to this feminized message, this feminine music, crying their eyes out, talking about their emotional problems, weeping, writing on Facebook about how they're suicidal because their girlfriend left them. And they're acting like young girls. They're not acting like young men. They're not dusting themselves off and getting back out there and enjoying the hurly-burly masculine activities that every young male should enjoy in their youth. They're sat in their bedroom, listening to George Michael, crying their eyes out, sobbing into their pillow because their girlfriend dumped them. And this is a devastating effect on young men. They're no longer growing up to be disciplinarians, the people who would impart order and strength to the next generation. But they're growing up to be weak, withered, and emasculated versions of what men should be. And when you look back, I was watching a documentary not too long ago about the Battle of Stalingrad, and it genuinely moved me. You had young German boys, far younger than me. I mean, I'm 36, and these were young men, but 20, 21, sometimes younger. And they stood there and made an oath to fight to the death rather than be captured. And they did this not with tears in their eyes, but as strong, proud young men. Imagine young men today doing something like that. You can't. Because these young men are getting triggered. They're getting emotionally wound up over the slightest thing. They're having to go to universities and colleges, and if they're challenged, if just ideas are thrown at them they don't agree with, they're having to crawl off to safe spaces where they can curl up and cry for half an hour, whilst counsellors pat them on the back and give them circles of paper so they can write down their feelings in wax crayon so they can't harm themselves with their writing utensils. And this is in less than 100 years, you've got the brave men who are 20, 21, who elected to fight to the death in Stalingrad, which was probably the most brutal fighting the world's ever known. And from that, you've gone to people of the same age crying their eyes out because they heard something that they didn't agree with or that they felt hurt them on some emotional level. Mm-hmm. How sick is that?
Okay, now you talk about salvations. Obviously, you don't think it's too late. You talk about false salvations and true salvation. Oh, and before we get into that, I just want to give you an opportunity to say the website, how people can get your book.
Oh, you can download my book for free. It's available at my website, www.thefallofwesternman.com. I'm sure the link can be in the description for people to get that if you're listening on YouTube. But back to what Patrick asked about the situation of false salvation and real salvation. Well, our enemies aren't stupid, and they know that we are ultimately winners. We created the greatest civilization the world has ever known, a civilization that held the world in awe. We put a man on the moon. We invented everything that has shaped the modern world, from medicine to the aeroplane to the combustion engine, and also all decent literature, art, and poetry. Our achievements are only matched by their number. The only thing that's more amazing than the achievements themselves is the number of achievements that we brought about. So our enemies know not only are we not stupid, but we're tenacious, we're fighters, we're warriors, we're inventors, we are winners. So they were clever, and they knew that some of us would get on to their games. So in front of us, they placed false salvations, and they placed things like conservatism, libertarianism, and of course, the Hollywood Nazi. They place things in front of us so that instead of confronting them in a meaningful manner, we would confront our enemies in ways that were designed to ensure that we failed every time. But there is good news. There is real salvation. And that real salvation is nationalism. And it starts with you. Now, people sometimes say that what I'm saying sounds like I'm preaching. And if it does, well, I apologize. But making a change starts with you. It starts with all of us. And as I've said before, the poison that they push is highly addictive. It's something that makes you want to buy into it. It's pleasurable. Eating is pleasurable. Sexual release is pleasurable. Sitting inside playing computer games or drinking alcohol or taking drugs, all of these poisons are pleasurable. And that's why they're easy to push, because ultimately our id craves pleasure. And only by developing our superego, only by becoming the masters of ourselves and looking at what we're doing and moderating our decisions, can we be better people and can we reach for the stars yet again. We have to look at ourselves and see where we're going wrong. And once we've seen that, and once we've set ourselves on a path of self-improvement, we can then become beacons to others. We can then rebuild our shattered communities, and we can rebuild them around excellence, around a vision of a better future, around traditionalism, around our heritage, around our illustrious history, and around our culture. But that does start with you. And this isn't preaching, because everyone, including me, has fallen for some of these traps. We've all fallen into these pitfalls, but we need to remove ourselves and we need to raise ourselves up, and not just for the good of ourselves, but for the good of our people and for the good of our community. And we have to set an example. And we've seen over the last 12 months that when we do pull together, we can win. We can rebuild our communities and we can give a bloody nose to our enemies. And I mean that not literally. I'm not inciting violence. I mean a metaphorical bloody nose, like we did with Brexit and like we did with Trump. We are masters of our own destiny, and you can make a change. You can start tomorrow with a fresh new day and a fresh new outlook to improve yourself and to stop pursuing hedonistic pleasure and to start pursuing a community-based alternative.
So you mentioned Brexit, you mentioned Trump, and you might as well have mentioned a lot of the demonstrations and backlash against the massive immigration that's taking place in countries across Europe. So it seems that you see this as the start of a true salvation rather than Trump or Brexit as being a false salvation. Do you think it's a true salvation? Do you think it is too little, too late, or is there enough time for an awakened people to take control of their situation and their destiny?
No, let me make this clear. Trump and Brexit are the beginning of our true salvation. They're beginning of a European awakening, a beginning of a move against immigration, and a beginning of a move towards nationalism and national sovereignty. But please, this isn't the end. These are just the first victories in what I hope will be many, many more victories, which I hope will start with Marine Le Pen in France this year. I hope she takes a victory. I hope she wins the presidential election. I hope the Front National are successful. And I hope this spreads like a cleansing fire across the whole of Europe. But this is the beginning of a true salvation, of a return to values, morality, traditions, and culture. Trump's shown that. That's what he stood for. And he was totally uncompromising. And that's why people got behind him. People got behind Brexit because it was about Britain standing up against the European Union. It was about people fighting for their sovereignty, their culture, control of their borders. This is the beginning of a national awakening. It's not conservatism. It's not libertarianism. And it's not a skinhead concert or the Hollywood Nazi gatherings that you would see on films like Romper Stomper or American History X, which are, of course, there to associate National Socialism with degenerate negatives. This is about people waking up and saying, I don't want anything more to do with the SJW agenda. I'm sick of feminism. I'm sick of multiculturalism. I'm sick of globalism. I want to embrace my culture and my traditions. I want sovereignty over my own land, and I want to put my own people first. And that is our true salvation, and that is nationalism.
And it's worthy of note that you look at, for instance, the Trump election in the United States, and he says America first, and he's the peace candidate. This is not an aggressive type of Hollywood nationalism that's going to lead to World War III. He very well saved us from World War III, because you look at the opposition to Trump, and you look at Hillary, the people around her, and the media that supported her, that's vilifying Vladimir Putin, that's vilifying Iran, that's vilifying President Assad in Syria, and really calling for a situation that would be bound to lead to a World War III, or at least some sort of horrific global conflagration. Okay, we're coming up towards the end of the show. Is there anything else you would like to say?
I'd just really like to thank everyone who's helped me with the book. I mean, there's some dedications in the book, but I'd just like to thank you, Patrick. You've done an awful lot for me. I appreciate coming on the show. Obviously, I'd also like to thank Dr. David Duke. He's been a great friend and a great supporter. It's always a pleasure being on his show, and an honor as well. It's a pleasure knowing both of you. I'd like to extend my thanks to everyone who's downloaded the book or bought the book, and everyone who's supported me over the years. And I'd like just to urge everyone, please, just give it a download. It's free. I don't believe in putting information and knowledge behind a paywall. That's why I've put it out there for free. It's a sizable book. It's 324 pages. Please go out there, give it a read, and hopefully we can continue on the path of redemption, and we can win a future for all European peoples all over the world, whether that be us in Europe or the European Americans over there in the United States. And it's you guys who have delivered us such a stunning victory at the end of last year. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's thefallofwesternman.com.
Yep, www.thefallofwesternman.com. And you can also get hold of me on YouTube. I've got a YouTube channel just in my own name. Search for me, Mark Collett. And if you want, add me on Facebook. I accept friend requests from all good nationalists. So join me there and join in the discussion. It'd be great to make your acquaintance.
Well, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Patrick.
Okay, and everyone, please join us next time for another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
Clocks back 60 years. Food was different. Food provided health and nutrition, and using supplements was minimal. Unfortunately, now we have chemicals, GMOs, herbicides, and pesticides that can be quite lethal in the name of our food supply and, of course, the ever-loving dollar. Supplementing our diets can be very important to stay healthy. Cleansing from daily intruders to the body might be critical. Live strong and take charge. Log on to GetTheTea.com. Our herbal tea is a great way to cleanse from intruders. Our supplements is a great way to maintain and improve your health. When your health is not up to par, go to GetTheTea.com. No GMOs, no fillers, and organic. And very helpful in keeping you at the top of your game. Life is too short to feel, you know what I mean. Stay in the game, at the top of your game, with GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Again, GetTheTea.com.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.